dodges the carnage, Jorge drops the hammer, and Fabio speeds up the speed up. Welcome to episode 65 of Bike Life. Let's go! Yes, this is episode 65 of Bike Live here on Motorsport 101, and we have a bumper weekend of motorcycle racing to talk to you all about. We are looking back on the seventh round of the MotoGP, Moto2, Moto3 seasons, which took place at the Circuit de Catalunya, as we saw history made in Moto2, a first-time winner and the second youngest in history, in the case of Fabio Quartararo. An absolute shit show in Moto3, won by Andrea Bastianini, and the exact opposite in MotoGP, as a very tame Grand Prix was won once again by the resurgent Jorge Lorenzo. We'll talk about all the action from all three of those races over the next hour and a half or so. We'll also look back on the next round of the British Superbike Championship. They returned after a month away at Snetterton last weekend. Not a lot has changed if your name is Leon Haslam, as he took another double to extend his winning streak to 5 in this British Superbike season. We will also look ahead to this weekend as the World Superbike Championship heads stateside for its annual round at Laguna Seca. A lot to cram in to this week's edition of Bike Live, entitled Jorge Thorenzo, and introducing the man who came up with that name, it is once again Andre Harrison. Welcome, Dre.
Bring me Thanos! I had to get the Infinity War joke in there just out of the way at some point. But yes, hello everybody. Well, pleasure to be back. Apologies for not being on Motorsport on a one episode 146. People did ask me about that. Given my total watch time of Le Mans was about 14 minutes, I don't think it was all that fitting that I'd be there as a host. I'd be very quiet for the most part during that one. But pleasure to be back, and pleasure to get into what was a pretty heaped weekend of bike racing, if you ask me.
Yeah, it was. It was a good weekend, all things considered. Probably the best races were the races that we weren't expecting to be all that good, but we'll get into that very, very soon. But yeah, shout out to Jorge Lorenzo for doing his impression of, which was that house robot, that new house robot that I introduced late in Robot Wars with the hammer. Mr. Psycho. That's what Jorge Lorenzo reminded me of. Last weekend in Catalonia. Mr. Psycho probably wouldn't have worked as an intro, because that would have drawn a lot of questions from our listeners.
Chris Cook would love that one, but that'd be about it.
The Ducati lawyers would have probably been onto us for that. What do you mean, Mr. Psycho? Let's first of all tell you about the places you can find us. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/motorsport101. On Twitter, we are @motorsport_101. Our YouTube channel, youtube.com/motorsport101. Our website is motorsport101.com. You can find a new piece from Dre earlier this week surrounding the Ducati issue, which we're going to be discussing over the course of this show. And if you like us so much that you want to back us financially and earn yourself early access to both our weekly podcasts, patreon.com/motorsport101. Backing us at the $5 level, you earn yourself early access to our weekly podcasts. Back us at the $10 level, and you earn access to our Discord server and the ability to listen to our podcasts live as they are recorded. This week, I saw episode 146 of Motorsport 101 as we looked back on the 24 hours of Le Mans. As Dre Fernando Alonso took, in his own words, one of the most impressive Le Mans 24-hour victories any of us have ever seen.
Right. Did you hear I'm also marrying Jennifer Lawrence? But yes, dodging the any chance Fernando can get to, shall we say, pull his own chain when it comes to the quality of his Le Mans victories. Yes, our 2018 Le Mans review is going to be up by the time this goes up, episode 146. Curiously named, 2 down, 1 to go. I hope no one gets mad at the fact we named it after Fernando. I know how some of the British guys get mad about that in the WEC. But yeah, we'll be talking all about Le Mans. I wasn't there for this one, but Patrick Hofstetter was there taking my place instead. dead alongside RJ and King, although partly in spirit because the audio was a bit of a nightmare to chain together. So apologies for that one, if for any technical hiccups that was in that episode. It wasn't the usual ultra smooth buttery audio quality we normally have. It really did, trust me. Again, a sincere apologies for that one. I'll make 147 an all Patreon access episode to counteract it. It's only fair on that one. But you heard it here first on Bike Life. All of the 2018 Le Mans saw a shock disqualification post race in the LMP2 category, as well as Jeff had his Le Mans win taken off him too. I hope he doesn't lose a Formula E title next weekend in New York as well. But all of that, Pat, RJ, and King in episode 146, which will be out right now.
And episode 147 will be out next weekend, looking back on what's taking place this weekend as IndyCar returns, as does Formula One returning to Paul Ricard. Shout out to anyone who's able to send us a picture next week of listening to Motorsport 101 whilst trying to clear a snooker table, given that it's episode 147. Introducing episode 65 of Bike Live, and let's head to Catalunya. And for the first time this season, and the first time in, well, ages, we are starting in Moto2, because history was made last weekend. The second youngest winner in the history of this class, dating back to its inception in 2010. It says quite a lot, Dre, when the only person that's been able to do anything or do this at a younger age than you is Marc Marquez. You know you've done something quite special. But I have to say, last week when we previewed the Catalunya weekend, we didn't really talk an awful lot about the Moto2 race weekend, but we could have spoken about that race weekend and previewed the Moto2 Grand Prix for a good half an hour before mentioning Fabio Quartararo's name. But what a ride!
That was an astonishing performance. It wasn't even just the race itself. It was all weekend where it felt like Quartararo had been in the class for like 100 races already, and he was an established veteran of his pace. I mean, it was a bit of a surprise when he was fast in practice. It was a big surprise when he ends up sticking it on pole position on the Saturday, and then he just doubled down on that in the race victory. I mean, sure, yeah, Miguel Oliveira took the early lead, which is also quite shocking in its own right, which we'll get to in a minute. But when Quartararo took the lead of the race in the early going, he was gone. No one had an answer for him. It was a stunning bit of riding all weekend long. I don't know what happened in that speed up camp where Fabio has suddenly been able to put it all together and he's found something that's clicked on that speed up. I mean, I know they had a new carbon fiber swing arm on that bike, but you would never, not in a million years, would you ever guess that would be, you know, worth maybe a second a lap to get him into contention all of a sudden. I know speed up's not had the best of seasons overall, which makes it all the more shocking. So, it's been nothing short of an incredible weekend for Fabio Quartararo, and a nice reminder that, you know, just how much talent this kid was touted to have coming into Grand Prix motorcycle racing at the World Championship level.
He did, and he's been gradually improving as this year's gone on. He didn't score any of the first two races, but that's now his fifth consecutive points finish. Two of those in Spain and his home race at the Bugatti Circuit at Le Mans were top tens. Quartararo has been quietly going about his business, and in many ways, riding for a team like Speed Up, when you're quite an inexperienced rider, in many ways, the pressure is off you when you're riding for that team. But he did get a top six last year back at Misano in those filthy conditions we had there. He was seventh a couple of times last year as well, including his very, very first Moto2 race in Qatar at the start of last year. He was the next best rookie after Bagnaia and Binder, who, of course, were on much better bikes in much stronger teams last year. So in many ways, his performances in 2017 went under the radar. I was going to make that very point about Quartararo in that it just goes to show how, you know, to use the old sporting cliche, form is temporary, class is permanent. And, you know, we've seen some riders in the past, the likes of Oliveira, the likes of, you could argue, Danny Kent in Moto3, in that they wouldn't necessarily catch you in amazement straight away, even if they do come into the class with the greatest reputations. But you have to sort of think with these guys sometimes, don't you, Dre, that we're still talking about kids when they come into this paddock. Quartararo won the Junior World Championship at the age of 14 and 15.
15, yeah.
and obviously earned his way into the Grand Prix World Championship at the age of 15 as a result of that. And not all 15-year-olds are able to handle the pressure, the microscope that's on them in the Grand Prix paddock. You know, they don't all handle it particularly well, especially when you're being touted as the next Marc Marquez, which Fabio Quartararo was back in sort of 2014-15. When he came into Moto3, you know, he had those pole positions early in his debut season. He got on the podium a couple of times. I remember us speaking the very first two seasons of Bike Live coming into 2015, and we were thinking, is Quartararo going to win this championship as a rookie in Moto3? Because he was so sensational as a rookie in testing. Right. And it never really happened for him. But as I say, Ray, Fabio Quartararo is still only 19 years of age, and we sometimes forget, don't we, that these guys are operating in world championships under the highest of pressures. It's such a high pressure environment, and sometimes it takes them a while to mature.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who was born in 99, which is just one of those things that make you all feel old for a second. But he won the junior world title at 15. They bent the rules to get him into the world championship without having to miss out on a couple of races, because I think his birthday is in early May. So he was going to miss the first two rounds, because back then Moto3 had a minimum age limit of 16. So they had bent the rules to get him in, basically. And I remember MotoGP themselves were on their own website was hailing him as the French Marc Marquez right from the start. He had an almost unhealthy level of hype going into, going into the opening round of the World Championship when he was in there in the main event series. And it never really worked out for him. Murder. He had a couple of flashes of brilliance, but he never really stood out in Moto3. In that sense, again, you can make the case, given he's such a big guy, that he probably just wasn't a natural fit for the class. Someone like a Bo Benschneider or Jonas Volger, who were always kind of held back because of how small the Moto3 bikes are. So he ended up going up to Moto2 last season at the age of 18, and even then, that's still exceedingly young for a bike rider. And yeah, he's basically just gotten on with it. He's never complained. He's just plodded along, gotten on with his business, and just tried to find improvements on the bike. And as you say, I didn't realize he had all those top tens underneath him as well. But again, Quartararo is walking proof that, you know what, not every talent or every super talent we seem to tout or hype up, they're not going to be, you know, front runners straight away. I mean, we've been spoiled in recent years to have talents like Alex Rins to a degree, like Maverick Vinales, who was able to get on a Moto2 bike and be top tier almost immediately. While on the other side of the coin, like the last two major Moto2 champions we had were Johann Zarco and Tito Rabat, who won titles in their fourth seasons in the class. Matteo Pessini right now is riding as well as he ever in GP racing as well, and he's 32 years old, and like, he's been doing this for well over a decade and a half now. Some guys do get better with age, and even some of the greatest, like Max Biaggi, he won a World Superbike title at 41. So there's not every super talent is born equal. Some guys are just better than others. I mean, in the sense of you can make the case someone like Sandro Cortese was an early bloomer. He was brilliant in Moto3, but he never really showed the same talent in Moto2, and he looks like he's back to somewhere his best in World Supersport now. So different paths and different, you know, riding styles and natures are going to have an effect on how riders develop, and I hope this is the first of many more performances like this for Fabio, because the kid is clearly... I mean, the way he dominated the junior world title is unlike anything I've ever seen, and that class is not scrubs. Those are the most talented, you know, young teenagers in bike racing that are taking part in that junior championship.
Yeah, and if I Fabio just give you the names of some of the riders that he beat in 2014, it was his second junior world championship. He beat Jorge Navarro, Gambi Rodrigo, yeah, Marcos Ramirez, Nicolo Bulliger, Andrea Mino, Maria Herrera, Remy Gardner, Albert Arenas, Bradley Ray, Stefano Manzi. That's just your top 12. And they're all... look at where all those riders are. Some of them are Grand Prix winners. Some of them are British Superbike race winners in form of Bradley Ray. They've all gone on to have very, very strong careers in their own rights. And Quartararo was beating them at the age of 14. which you don't do if you aren't phenomenally talented. And not only do riders sometimes mature at different ages, but I think with Quartararo, when we're talking about going from Moto 3 to Moto 2, you have to remember how tall they are. And Quartararo is a 1.77 meter, so he's an inch short of 6 foot. And he's still only 19, so he's still growing as a man. So in many ways, he almost was forced to go out of Moto 3 up to Moto 2 because, you know, he was no longer, despite being phenomenally talented and perhaps as talented as anyone else within that class, he was no longer at a size where he fit and suited the bike and had to move up. And yeah. I draw parallels with riders like Lorenzo Baldessari, who was never really, I mean, he was a dominant champion in Red Bull Rookies, but never really amounted to much in Moto 3. Because he was, frankly, by the time he got there, he was already too tall for the bikes. And we're going to talk about a rider in Nicola Bulliger later on in Moto 3, who's having a terrible season and is struggling both on and off track. But he's 6 foot as well. And Bulliger's only 18 years old. So he's another rider that this time next year, towards the end of the season, we might all just be saying, look, it's not working out for him, but he's clearly talented. Get him into Moto 2. Because if you believe a rider is talented, even if they're not necessarily lighting up Moto 3, if you truly believe that rider is talented, stick with them and back them and give them the opportunity in Moto 2, which is what last year the Pons team did with the Quartararo, and this season's speed up have done that. And what a way to repay them to take speed up's first win since San Lowe's at the Circuit of the Americas back in 2015. So it's been a long time between drinks for that team. And it's difficult to know really how to quantify it, isn't it, Dre? Because a lot of people instantly pointed fingers Danny Kent's way on Sunday because he finished down in 21st position, 30 seconds behind his race-winning teammate. But it has to be said that if Quartararo had not won, which is, I admit, is a very big if, we'd have been looking at Danny Kent finishing down in 21st and thinking, well, that's just about where speed up are.
Yeah, it's like the age-old F1 question that I've seen in lopsided teams. I'll use the example of like the 2012 season, which was probably the best F1 season of recent times, where Fernando Alonso was basically hailed as the underdog in that Ferrari team against Sebastian Vettel, even though his car won 4 Grand Prix that season. And I think Alonso was on the podium something like 14 or 15 times that year. It was a weird one in that sense, because you have to often ask yourself, what's the proper baseline for that car? Is it Fernando? Is Fernando just that good? Or is Felipe Massa the more relevant baseline for that car? Is Alonso overperforming the car, or is Felipe Massa underperforming? It's one of those age-old debates you can have in your head. There's a case you can make for both. I think it's similar in this case here, where it's like speed up have not been competitive really this season, especially not when it comes to race wins and whatnot. It's easy to to throw shade at Danny Kent because the guy has always talked a very big game.
As I mentioned, it was Speed Up's first win since the start of 2015. It's their first podium since 2016.
Yeah, this is not a very good chassis at the moment in the context of MotoGP. KTM are clearly, on a par, if not only maybe half an inch behind the Kalex right now in Moto 2, and they are the only two chassis at the moment worth a damn. Speed up has not been the same since Sam Lowe's left them. That goes without saying. They've tried guys like Simone Corsi, and again, there's been an obvious drop in quality. And I know a lot of that is down to Lowe's being a quality Moto 2 rider, and on his day, a guy that could win multiple races and challenge for a title. But I think Danny Kent is a more relevant baseline for what the speed up is at the moment compared to Quartararo's victory. I don't think this is a matter of, oh, look, Danny Kent now looks stupid because look at Fabio, he's gone off and won a race. I mean, it's easy to do that. But I think 21st is
around where Danny Kent's been finishing all year.
Yeah, like Kent's performances this season, 17th, 12th, retirement, 21st, retirement, 21st. Fabio Quartararo, if I can just find him on my list in front of me here.
He's gone 20th, 22nd, 15th, 10th, 8th, 11th, first. That's a big jump.
Yeah, the question I've got to ask is, how is your team calibrated one of your bikes is winning a race and the other one is half a minute behind over a race distance? I think that's the more relevant question you need to be asking. Like, it's, I don't think it's a matter of, oh, Danny Kent is bad, ha ha, look at him. I think it's more a case of, well, why is your car so, why is your bike, should I say, so disjointed in terms of overall performance, where one guy can dominate and win a Grand Prix and the other guy is not in the points? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, it has been a strange, strange time. And it's been an open season, it has to be said, in Moto2. That's now five different winners in the first seven races in Moto2. Bagnaia, Oliveira, Baldassarre, Pessini, and now Quartararo. And there have been five different winners in Moto3 as well this season from the seven races we've had so far. We'll talk about that shortly. But the championship is still very, very close. Francesco Bagnaia, after Le Mans, looked like he was starting to pull away with it and dominate this championship, but he's gone fourth and eighth since then. Before we talk about Bagnaia's race, we have to talk about the man that's chasing him down, Miguel Oliveira. He's now gone first, second in the last two races from... Well, where was he on the grid in Mugello, Drake? 14th, wasn't it?
I think it was a bit lower than that. Hang on, I think it might have been 14th or 17th place. Well, he started
17th in Barcelona. But Mugello, the race before, I'm trying to think. I think he was 14th on the grid, which means he's taken 45 points from a combined, you know, his two grid positions add up to 31 from his last two races in grid slots. And, I mean, KTM cannot continue to get away with this, surely. But for Oliveira to continue to qualify badly, you know, that's, you know, we discussed this after Mugello, how they clearly have a problem with single lap pace and switching on the tires. And it must be what it is, because we always talk about KTM in Moto2 about, oh, they're so good at nursing their tires and having tire left at the end of a Moto2 race, which is all right and good, but they're clearly not switching them on in qualifying, are they?
It's tricky, because for some added context, in Mugello, Miguel Oliveira started that race from 11th on the grid, but he was the top KTM and he was only half a second off pole position. And I think James Toseland made the same point during the race itself. Toseland talked about how Oliveira was starting 17th in Barcelona, but he was only 0.8 off pole position. So it's not like he's a million miles away.
I think,
unfortunately, yeah, because all the bikes are so similar, half a tenth could cost you a row. That's how unfortunate it can be, because you look at some of these gaps, and again, the Mugello grid, you're looking at 300ths, 400ths, sometimes even less than that between some riders on the grid. Unfortunately, 8 tenths is a bit on the steep side in Moto2, and like, for some context, I'm glad Toseland pointed this out during the race, that, yeah, it's not quite as simple as, well, Oliveira's a terrible qualifier. I think it's more a case of, holy crap, these Moto2 grids are really close in qualifying, and a tenth can cost you dearly out here.
I don't think Catalonia was an Oliveira issue, though, because he wasn't the top KTM in qualifying in Barcelona. He was the fourth fastest KTM.
Yeah, Binder was on the second row.
Binder was fifth, Sam Lowes was ninth, and Ike Lecuona was 14th on the grid.
Right.
KTM. So Oliveira was, there was only one KTM that was slower than him in qualifying, and that was the recovering from injury Domi Agata.
Yes. Which
illustrates just how much he struggled. I mean, he had a crash earlier in the weekend, and there was talk that he was perhaps sort of riding slightly half injured, if you like, in qualifying. But even so, qualifying went badly for Oliveira, but the race didn't. Mainly, Dre, the hard work for Oliveira in climbing his way up the order was done in a tremendous opening lap.
I mentioned this before we went on the air. It's the best GP start I think I've seen since Marc Marquez went from the back of the grid to 12th at Valencia 2012, where through two corners, Marc Marquez is 12th. This was a similar case where Oliveira was starting 17th, and I think he was 5th by the time he got to turn 4. It was a stunning, stunning start from Miguel Oliveira. One of the best I've ever seen. This kid is insanely talented, I have to say. Like, his racecraft is absolutely world-class. I'm glad he's going to be in MotoGP next year, because, like, he keeps making his life difficult for himself in qualifying, which is one thing, but when your racecraft is that good, who frigging cares? Like, that's
an insane...
Yeah, my God. Please give him a front row start every once in a while. And I mean, at one point he was leading the race. He bullied Alex Marquez out of the way and was leading the race before Quartararo decided to put the hammer down and then put himself in front instead. But Oliveira at one point had gone from 17th to 1st. I mean, in probably, what, 4 or 5 laps. The kid is insane. There's no other way to describe it. And, you know, quite rightly, only a point of the champion. I mean, he's not stolen all the headlines in Moto2 this year. But he's only been off the podium twice this season. And he's been, you know, in the top 6 every single race. He's not really had a bad round, given where the state of the field is at the moment. He's riding very, very well. He's riding very consistently. His racecraft is excellent. He seems to just completely mastered this KTM a lot more than his teammate Brad Binder has. In the grand scheme of things at the moment, where Binder still has these reckless races sometimes, like we had in Jerez, and Binder seems to be hitting the wall at sixth place. He's finished there 5 times this season already. 5 6th place finishes for Brad Binder. He must be really getting sick and tired of that sixth place. But Oliveira, another stunning bit of racecraft to get himself up the field so quick. He did it in Jerez, where I think he was 14th and he went up to finish second in that one too, and he's done it again here. It's quality. It really is. Again, if he needs to stop making his life so hard for himself just by giving him a bit more of a clean run, especially at the start of races. But as said, it's clearly not hurting him very much when he can get through the field that quickly. It's very Jonathan Rea-esque from Miguel at the moment, and that's a very, very high amount of praise you can say regarding his ability. It's very impressive, and I look forward to seeing if he's able to take a few more wins and take the fight to Bagnaia, who was a bit mediocre this week. He just didn't have the overall pace that she's shown on occasions this season.
Yeah, he did. And I have to say, Oliveira's race on Sunday pretty much went entirely to plan, right the way until about half the straight after the finish line. And obviously the race had finished by then, so in many ways it doesn't matter. But we do have to talk about this, Dre. What happened 300 metres or so down the straight after the checkered flag, where Miguel Oliveira sits up. He's cruising at sort of, well, a quarter of the racing speed, as you would after the race is finished.
Yeah.
And suddenly gets tailgated by a rider going at full speed. That rider is Simone Corsi. Now, Simone Corsi's been handed a back-of-the-grid start for Assen, and I haven't heard Simone Corsi try to argue with it. I know it probably was the kind of thing he'd do, but he can have no defence here, can he? Why would any rider be going at full racing speed after the race is finished?
Quite rightly, yeah. I mean, there is zero defence for that, in my humble opinion. I mean, it's basically the same penalty Carol Hanaker got when he was in Moto3, where he basically, I think he hit Guevara after the bell, basically after the race had finished in the ref, he was almost headhunted him, so to speak. And I don't think this was deliberate.
Yeah, Marquez had a very similar penalty for running into Willerott after the checkered flag in Australia in 2011. Well, he was given a 6-second penalty in qualifying, which was as good as a back-of-the-grid start. Where they had to give him the exact figure, which would put him at the back of the grid, but put him within the 107% and allow him to start. Why this could have been so bad was that the race had finished. So obviously riders are rightly slowing down, but this was on the straight. So it's not as if there was runoff either side of them. There was a concrete wall over to the left, which one of them could easily have fallen into. But also, when the race finishes, marshals come onto track. You've got marshals at the side of the road waving flags who could easily have been caught up in this. At some races, of course, you could have spectators on the track, which again could make it worse. And you've got a rider still travelling at racing speeds. You know, this could have been so, so much worse than it was. Fortunately, Oliveira was confused and nothing else, wondering why the hell someone had ran into him after the race had finished. And he had to basically make it back to Parc Fermé and the podium on foot. But Simone Corsi, he escaped injury but didn't escape penalty, which was just as well. Because it was an awful piece of riding, and quite rightly he's been sent to the back of the grid for Assen as a result of it. You mentioned Francesco Bagnaia, who finished down in 8th, continuously the championship, but only leads it by 1 point. But in many ways, it depends if your glass is half empty or half full, because he didn't panic in many respects. He still got it to the flag and still banked some points. which could prove crucial at the end of the season. And it kind of illustrates, Dre, just who the classes of this field have been in Moto2 this season. When I tell you that only two riders so far this year in Moto2 have scored points in every single race, and they are Bagnaia and Oliveira.
Indeed, and I think they're only two of the three that have not had a single DNF. I think only Andrea Telli, and ironically, Simone Corsi are the other two on that front. Where, yeah, you're absolutely right. They are the class of the field right now. Where they just, I mean, that was by Bagnaia's standards a substandard round by finishing in eighth. No one's denying that. It was a bit like Argentina. He just wasn't a contender around there either. He finished in ninth. But by any measure, again, like he didn't panic. He didn't override the bike. He didn't have a DNF. That was, you know, that was the most that was on the table for him. You know, I mean, in Moto2, with it being such a close and such a competitive class, you know, that is, you can have bad days. Quite often you can have bad days where you can have a crash or you're just not in contention. And better to bank some points than have a donut next to your name on this occasion. So, yeah, I completely agree. I mean, those, I think Oliveira and Bagnaia are the two best riders in the class right now. They don't make very many mistakes. Oliveira's racecraft has been superb. When Bagnaia is on it, he wins. It's as simple as that. He has, I think, more ultimate pace during the race than anyone else does when he's clicking with that calyx that he's got at the moment. So yeah, at the minute, I think those two are the class of the field, and I think Alex Marquez and Lorenzo Baldassarre, who are third and fourth, being about a race back, it does make sense given they both have critical DNFs to their name. Alex didn't finish in Jerez; that was a silly crash from him from when he was in third place that day, and Baldassarre didn't, overdid it at Le Mans basically. So yeah, it makes sense that they're about a race behind. It's a shame because we could have had a real four-way title fight, but it's starting to have Oliveira and Bagnaia start to break out a little bit from that leading group. So we'll be interested to see if Baldassarre and Marquez can pull them back in at some point.
The next round, of course, is at Assen. As you're listening to this, a week from now. Here's how the Moto2 race finished. Then Quartararo, the first-time winner from Oliveira and Marquez. The Dynavolt calyxes of Strotter and Vieje continued to figure around the top six, and they were fourth and fifth respectively, ahead of the forever sixth Brad Binder. Lorenzo Baldassarre seventh, Pecco Bagnaia eighth, Sam Lowe's ninth, that's his best of the year. Not sure whether that's a good or a bad thing, but he was ninth ahead of Iker Lecuona, his teammate, who completed the top ten. Andrea Locatelli 11th, Simone Corsi 12th. And this, again, just illustrates how dumb he was after the race to take out Oliveira, given that Oliveira finished the race some, 13.5 seconds ahead of him. So it took 13.5 seconds for Simone Corsi to come down the straight and tailgate into him at full racing speed. He was 12th ahead of Nagashima. Augusto Fernandez is namesake Raul's in Moto3. Augusto Fernandez, who was the replacement for Hector Barbera at the Pons team, he was 14th ahead of the fit again Remy Gardner, who took the final point in 15th. Bagnaia leads the championship by just 1 point now over Oliveira. It's 119 over 118. Marquez is third on 94, one ahead of Baldassarre in fourth. Vieje fifth on 70. Joan Mir, who crashed out of this race shortly after signing for Suzuki, had his first crash of the year, in sixth now on 64. Pessini, who also fell off, he's on 58 points in seventh. Binder's a point behind Pessini in eighth. Schrotter ninth. Quartararo has jumped all the way into the top 10 now on 45 points. Moto3 up next, and as I said at the very start of this show, an utter shit show of a Moto3 race. We've had a bit of a mixed bag of Moto3 races so far this season. Some of them have been tamed by Moto3 standards. Some of them have been absolutely crackers. This was certainly the latter. And before we talk about who will ultimately win it, Dre, we kind of have to go through this chronologically, don't we? So let's start with Jorge Martin, who took a very, very similar strategy to the one which worked for him so well in Mugello, where it was pretty clear where he thought, I want this to be as small a group as possible at the front, so I'm going to stretch these boys out right from the start.
Right.
By basically going out from the gun. He wasn't on pole this time. It was Bastianini on pole. But Martin got the whole shot, essentially went on an early time attack and broke everyone bar Tatsuki Suzuki. He was the one rider able to keep up with him. That left us what we thought was a straight fight for the win between Martin and the Japanese, until Martin crashes out on lap 9. He loses the front at turn 9. And before we talk about what followed, from Jorge Martin's point of view, he's had a lot of bad luck fall his way this year. Perhaps wins that could have been his had other riders not crashed into him and had he not been caught up in other people's incidents. But on this occasion, another donut for Martin, and this one entirely his own making.
Indeed. In tennis circles, we would call that an unforced error. And that, like, it's a strange one because you don't normally see guys lose it at that very fast turn nine. Just tuck the front and just completely sit out from underneath him. Very bizarre accident. And yeah, that, you're absolutely right. Just a silly mistake from Martin. He's got no one to blame but himself on that one. To crash out from the front like that is unforgivable. A massive, massive error in a race he was probably going to finish second at worst, given the way the race had played out in the early going. I mean, the second group behind him, they were giving chase, but not enough of a rate of knots to really be a factor in this. And yeah, like, Martin's game plan was working perfectly until then. And yeah, it's been a real shame. I mean, Martin is now becoming like a bit of a win it or bin it sort of guy now, unfortunately, where it's like, he's been collected in so many other incidents now that he's now got three DNFs in the last four races. But in those last five races, the other two have been wins.
The only three races he's had this season where he's had a trouble-free clear race, he's won.
Yeah, like, Martin is brilliant. He's the class of the field. He is a demolition job when he comes. I've never seen a Moto3 rider with that much of a pace advantage consistently over the field where he can... He's the only guy I've seen in terms of who can stretch massive groups. I've not seen anybody else able to do that besides maybe Danny Kent in the first half of his title winning season. And even then, the field caught up to him in the second half of that season without question. So he's a freak in that sense where he's got so much natural pace on that bike where he can basically break the toe, which is practically unthinkable in that sort of category now in Moto3. But he's either been unlucky to have been collecting another sheer bad luck, or this case where he just made a silly mistake, and now all of a sudden we've got to be sitting there with him now, 23 points off the title lead, asking ourselves, is he still the title favourite now? Mm. Because like, Marco Bezzecchi is not having very many bad here, and he had a very solid set of 20 points to take home this weekend, so the way it's going right now, Jorge Martin's got some work to do.
He has. We'll talk about Bezzecchi in just a moment, but following on from Martin's crash, that left Tatsuki Suzuki all alone, and let's pour one out for the Japanese, because he was dreaming at what was would have been at worst second behind Martin. I mean, to be fair, we were at a stage in the race where that second group had started to calm down a bit, and they were allowing Bastianini and Canet, the two established names, to tow them up to the front two, and they might have got there anyway, by the end of the race. But as it was, Suzuki, who was using Martin as a bit of a pacemaker to tow him away from the second group, suddenly had no one to tow him away and had to do all the work himself and was unable. As soon as he was left alone, Dre, he was reeled in with about a lap and a half. They suddenly just pulled him straight back in, and we had a group at the front again, which is where the trouble started. I think we had about 11 or so riders in this front group fighting for the win, and only five of them made it to the flag. The first reason for that was what happened at turn four, when the Le Mans winner, Albert Arenas, essentially had a bit of a brain fade, didn't he, into turn four, where he just completely outbraked himself and skittled out Nicolò Buliger and Aaron Canet into the bargain. And Canet, who's not even been on the podium since Argentina. He started off with 2 seconds and led the championship. He's not even been in the top seven since then. He's had 2 8s and 11th, and now 2 DNFs. But both Canet and Buliger, completely innocent bystanders in basically someone else's accident.
Indeed, yeah, it's an unfortunate one. That's the nature of Moto3 when you're racing such tight groups. There's a much greater chance you get collected, and yeah, it's a real shame. Albert Arenas basically outbroke himself into turn four. You could see he was breaking way too late. And Buliger's taken the corner thinking no one else is going to be there. And of course, he's not seen Arenas just diving for the apex of turn four and not seen it. And they've tangled. And obviously, Canet got skittled out in the process too. And as much as like, as much as obviously I feel a little bit of sympathy for Nicolò Buddiga, don't shout at a man that's been stretchered off like that. I saw that during the race and I thought that was quite scummy. Like, Reynes has clearly hurt himself. He was crawling away, had to be stretched off, and Buddiga is basically bollocking the man from a distance while he's being stretched off, which I think is quite disgusting, actually. I mean, the guy's clearly hurt and injured, and I don't think he's done that on purpose by any stretch. I mean, there's a time and a place for that sort of thing. I don't think that's the one. But, obviously, yeah, unfortunate.
I saw that as well. I mean, I'm slightly more prepared to just let it go as heat of the moment, loss of temper.
Yes.
And I'd like to think that, you know, in the cold heart of day, Buddiga would not ever consider doing that. And I did sympathise with Buddiga before he started yelling at a guy who's half conscious on a stretcher. I did feel for him. I really felt for the kid because he was, you know, it's been well documented how much of a bad season he's been having and how much trouble he's having on and off track. And the kid was having his best weekend for ages. He was leading the Grand Prix a lap or two prior to this. And looking really good. And, you know, boy, that kid deserves a result at some stage. And it looked like this was going to be it. And then, lo and behold, he gets taken out by another rider. And yeah, there is no defence for shouting at a guy who's been stretched away. But it's pretty clear that the anger and the frustration of a year or so's poor results and bad luck kind of came out of Buddiga there when he looked like he was finally about to break out of that cycle.
Championship-wise, Nicolò Buddiga is the worst of the full-time riders.
No points yet this season. The only best full-time rider not to have scored a point this season, which says it all. He's having a poor time of it. That wasn't the end of the mayhem, it has to be said, in that front group, because we were left with six or seven now at the front of the field. Two more dropped out with about four laps to go into turn one, and again, two more riders who could arguably have felt that on another day, this might have been their race to win. In fact, Jean Mercier was one of the riders who led the race at some stage and actually set the fastest lap of the race. Kept the fastest lap to the end of the race. But just as he was lining himself up, perhaps a late charge to try and win the Grand Prix, he trips over Andrea Migno.
Yeah, he trips over Migno and ends up taking him out. It's just another case where guys are just trying to find some space as they were going four or five wide into turn one, and you know, one guy's taking, you know, evasive action, and you know, one thing leads to another, and next thing you know, you've got two more dudes in the canvas. It became a leading group of five, which is just unfortunate, really. It's one of those things.
Much to the delight of BT Sport, it was being led at this point by John McPhee.
Of course.
On the CIP Green Power KTM. He would go on to finish fourth. And through this race that we've just described, where so much chaos and so much carnage happened, the guy that started on pole won it anyway. So what was the point in all of that? And AF Bastianini comes through to win. It's his first win since late 2016, back when he beat Brad Binder at Motegi, I think it was, from memory, where Bastianini took his last win. And not just in terms of his career and where his career was heading, but in terms of this year's championship, this was a win that Enea badly needed.
Super badly. He had a pretty bad season for a guy that we thought was going to be a title contender this year. We thought this might finally be the year that Enea Bastianini puts it together and actually has a serious title challenge, and he's still got some work to do. I mean, he's still 35 points off the top of the championship, but that's a start. He needed a win really badly. We know he's capable of wins. He always has been. And yeah, he managed to survive the chaos, broke out about a two or three bike length advantage on the final lap, and no one was able to get close to him, and he took what looked like actually a fairly comfortable victory in the end. Wasn't really pressed all that hard on the final lap. And yeah, a win he badly needs for his championship to get it back in line. Because again, the fortunate thing for him is that so many other contenders and guys that would normally be taking points off him did not finish this race. So yeah, well done to Bastianini and Bezzecchi. Sometimes there is, you know, an element of safety in just surviving sometimes, and he did that excellently here.
Yeah, and from Bastianini's point of view, of course, McPhee led onto the final lap, but Bastianini just pulled the pin, didn't he, on that final lap? Got it to the front at turn one, and then just basically eventually did a one-lap time attack on the final lap and was able to basically stay far enough clear of the rest of the field into all the crucial braking zones that no one could really have a go at him on that final lap. But I want to mention Bezzecchi, though, who finished second. Extends his championship lead now. It's 19 points over Di Gian Antonio, who Went off onto the gravel early on, dropped outside the top 20, but through attrition and not giving up, clawed his way back into 7th, and is now up into 2nd place. Martin's 23 points off the lead, but it's tempting initially to look at that from Bezzecchi and think, so much carnage happened in that race, and you know there was a bit of luck in staying out of all the trouble and getting to the flag in 2nd.
Yep.
But I don't see it that way, Dre. I mean, Bezzecchi said after the race, my attitude was I had to try and stay at the front of the group all the time, which is the best way of staying out of trouble, I find. And we'll look at his results now. He's had that one DNF since the first round in Qatar where he was going to be on the podium had he not fallen off when he tangled with Martin. But he's been on the podium in every race since Qatar, except for Le Mans. And I don't look at races like that and Bastianini getting stuff like in 2nd and think that was lucky. I think, no, that's what champions do.
Yeah, that's exactly what champions do. Is you points and you score and it's not your best day. Bezzecchi never really looked like he was going to win the race. And, okay, he didn't in the end, but he still took an excellent 20 points. And he's done that now. 3 of the last 4 races he's been involved in. And of course, he was skittled out a little bit at Le Mans. But he's now consistently scoring points. He's done it 5 out of the last 6 races. Where he's now finished on the podium, and besides that, you know, opening race in Qatar, he's been, you know, the forward in Jorge Martin's side, and for the whole championship, he's not having bad days. He's always up the front, and if you're doing that in Moto3, you are a very, very good rider indeed. So, yeah, as it stands, the consistency is really paying off for him. And you know what, with guys like Martin and Canet and Mino not finishing. He's now got a 19 point. He's got a clear advantage now at the top. He's actually got a little bit of a safety net in front of him now going forward.
He has. He's now, as you say, 19 points clear. Dejan Antonio takes 2nd. He is, as I scan down the Moto3 results, I think Dejan Antonio is now the only rider to have scored points in every round. In fact, he is. Mignot was the other, but he, of course, crashed out or was taken out in Catalunya. So Dejan Antonio, through sheer consistency, is up to 2nd now in the championship, and he just needs to try and sort of add wins to that, doesn't he? And he might well be a real contender too. Dejan Antonio, who speculation built up over the weekend, or it was certainly the first time I'd heard it, that Dejan Antonio might well be replacing Jorge Navarro at the Gresini Moto2 team next year. We shall see. We'll keep an eye on that one, and if any news does break on that, concrete news, we will bring it to you on this show. So the Moto3 result, Bastianini the winner for the first time this season from Bezzecchi. Congratulations though to Gabby Rodrigo, his first career podium in 3rd position, although he was 2nd coming out of the final corner. The extra straight line speed that Bezzecchi always seems to have just got into the finish line 0.03 of a second ahead of the Argentine. But Rodrigo gets his first podium in 3rd, John McPhee in 4th. Quite comfortably his best result of the season so far. Tatsuki Suzuki did stick around and ended up 5th ahead of his compatriot Keita Toba, who finished a career best 6th. Dejan Antonio climbed to 7th in the end ahead of Alonso Lopez, who we haven't really seen since that miraculous performance in Jerez earlier this year. The next of the Spanish rounds saw him return to form in 8th ahead of Denis Foggia 9th, and Raul Fernandez, who's the current junior world championship leader. He took 10th on the extra Angel Nieto KTM. Jakub Kornfeld was 11th ahead of Makar Yurchenko, the Kazakh, in 12th. Adam Noradin in 13th. First points of the season for Nakarin Atarat Fubapat in 14th. And Livio Loy takes the final point in 15th position. Bezzecchi's championship lead, as we told you, is up to 19 points over Dejan Antonio, with Martin a further 4 points back in 3rd. Bastianini is up into 4th. On 68, so he's now 35 off the lead. Canet is 5th on 61, 42 back. Rodrigo's up to 6th on 57, 1 point ahead of Mino, who drops a spot to 7th. Nicolo Antonelli, who dislocated his shoulder and didn't ride last weekend, he is now 8th on 44 points, 3 ahead of Jakob Kornfeld in 9th, and Marcos Ramirez completes the top 10. Right now, time for perhaps the shortest MotoGP roundup in the history of Bike Live. As we look back at the Premier Class last weekend in Catalunya. And it has to be said, Dre, 2 things really stood out in the run-up to the Grand Prix, as in 2 things from free practice and qualifying that really took our attention. The first of them was the miraculous save of Marc Marquez in FP4. Now, this is perhaps the most memorable thing to happen all weekend, which kind of says a lot. But no matter how many times this guy continues to do this kind of thing, it doesn't make it any less impressive, does it?
There's no words to describe this. This is outrageous.
He was impressed by it.
Yeah, I think he was giving it the finger wag afterwards, like, holy cow. To put it into perspective, it's the final corner. It's Catalunya corner itself, the turn 14. You're going into that corner at about 140 miles an hour. He's done again.
It's a long corner.
It's a long corner, and the slide that he puts on through there, and he doesn't fall off. This is at 125 miles an hour. This was clocked at. It's unheard of. It's even. I mean, when we talk about the Valencia save towards the end of, that was 95 miles an hour. This is at 125, and he saved it on his knee and on his hand and his arm. I do not know how he does this. He's the only man on the planet that can do this. It is utterly insane. I don't even know how to keep describing this. I mean, it's one of those things where he's had five or six absolutely outrageous saves now. They're putting montages of this shit together now. He's having so many of these. And, like, this one might be the greatest save of them all. This one's definitely up there with Valencia. That's just absolutely outrageous. Like, you can see the side. It looks like something out of Photoshop. Like, how on earth is he saved that? It's utterly ridiculous.
Yeah, go back. If you're listening in the UK, you can do this. If you're not, then I'm afraid you'll discount what I'm about to say. If you're listening in the UK, you can head over to BT Sports MotoGP Twitter account. At BT Sport MotoGP, and they still have the video on there, and just watch it. It's not often I would recommend the commentary, but listen to it with the commentary. And Keith Hughes and Neil Hodgson's just, they're aghast at how on earth has he stayed on that bike. Almost like just amazement of he saved it. That's the thing with Marc Marquez. He does it time and time again, but it still amazes us that he's able to do this, because he's defying the laws of physics, the laws of gravity, the laws of any kind of logic on a motorcycle. To be able to do those kind of things, to the point where his leather manufacturers are actually designing special patches on Marc Marquez's elbows to stop him from burning a hole through his leathers, because they know he's going to need that part of his arm rescue the bike. And it's amazing. He's now having leathers custom made for that exact eventuality, which is extraordinary. Marc Marquez, again, ladies and gentlemen. But as I say, there were two things that stood out from free practice and qualifying. That was one of them. The other one, Dre, was just how incredible and how impressive a pace Jorge Lorenzo seemed to have over the long runs. In FP4 and in free practice, he looked to have the superior pace over a race distance. And come 2 o'clock on Sunday, so it proved.
Yes. It was the sort of thing where it's like Lorenzo was fast in practice. I didn't read too much into it, but as the season, as the weekend went on, he just proved that he just was that fast all the way through. Marquez was the only guy that could even stay with him in the early goings of that race. But Lorenzo, again, just like his pace is just metronomic. It is utterly insane how he keeps doing this, where at one point, like, they are literally basically just going. You can measure his lap times to within hundreds of a second.
I'll list them out to you, because I've got the lap charts in front of me. It's a 24-lap race. Obviously, discount the first lap because it's from a standing start. But from lap 2, Lorenzo goes 40.4, 40.2, 40.1, 40.2, 40.3, 40.1, 40.0, 40.0, 40.1, 40.0, 40.0, 40.1. He then has a bit of a relapse on lap 14, does a 40.5. Lap 15, he's back down to a 40.4, 16, 40.3. Then he goes 40.4, 40.4, 40.4. 40.7, 40.3, 40.6, 40.9, and then the final lap when he's grandstanding, a 41.2. How do you beat that?
You don't. It's as simple as that. Like, if he's doing 41 deads, which is basically the fastest lap of the race, four laps in a row, no one in the field has that level of consistency. No one. No one I've ever seen in bike racing has that level of consistency.
And he can do it on a soft front and a soft rear tyre.
Yeah, a tyre that's going to degrade faster than most, he is still able to you know, do things on a bike that literally no one else can in terms of consistency. No one else can do that. It's utterly insane. And yeah, when he does that, he's in the front and he's in that sort of pace. You're not beating him. It's as simple as that. And, you know, Marquez, he was the only other guy that had the pace to challenge him. But I think when a key moment of Andrea Dovizioso hitting the deck happened, I think he took the 20 points, which I think might have been the smarter move for the sake of the championship.
Yeah, and it's with Lorenzo, right. It's that strategy. It's death by a thousand cuts, isn't it? If you're his opponent, because there's not one single lap or one single moment that breaks your opposition. It's just that sheer relentlessness. It's that I can do this for the entire race. If you drop off for one lap, if you can't match this pace for one lap, you're gone. And even if you're a tenth slower over 24 laps, that's 2.5 seconds, and you've lost by 2.5 seconds, because Lorenzo could just continue to run at that pace for the entire Grand Prix. It's just a sheer reminder of when he's on form and when he's got the bike suiting him and when everything's in harmony, there are precious few, if anybody, in the world as good as Jorge Lorenzo. It is a pleasure to watch, even if it's not necessarily particularly exciting to watch if you're after a particularly close Grand Prix. Because as you say, Marc Marquez pretty much settled for second and decided 20 points was enough for him once Andrea Dovizioso crashed from behind him out of third place. And in the end, it kind of sums up a bittersweet race, as I've described it, for Ducati, because they won the Grand Prix for the second race in a row, but their championship hopes probably died with it.
Yeah, because Andrea Dovizioso hit the deck at turn 5 in the early going, trying to chase Lorenzo and Marquez.
And all those points he gained at Mugello, he's handed straight back again.
Yeah, so we're back to where we started two rounds ago with Andrea Dovizioso, the main title 2017, the antagonist that took Marquez to the absolute limit last season, is now 49 points off the top again, and he's lost two rounds of progress trying to chase that gap up now. So
his teammate, the championship.
Yeah, and now he's behind Lorenzo. Lorenzo's now ahead of the count back. They have the exact same number of points on 66. They're not even the best Ducati in the championship. That goes to Danilo Petrucci right now, who has 5 points more than him. The way it's going right now, this year might be a write-off for Ducati, because I can't see where they're going to get 50 points on Marquez between now and the end of the year. Marquez still has a couple of real banker circuits in front of him coming up later in the year, i.e. probably obviously the Saxon Ring in a couple of rounds' time. Aragon is becoming a real, you know, Marquez round at home for him. Phillip Island, we don't talk about so much, but he's excellent around Phillip Island as well. He's very, very good round there too. So the way it's going at the moment, it's looking rough for Ducati. I mean, Lorenzo could be the guy to spearhead the team going towards the end of the season. The way the last two rounds have gone, it looks like Lorenzo has a number on his teammate again. And Dovi, who, you know, was the, you know, the fighter, the all-round package of last season, now in the last three races made two very silly mistakes.
When we look at the championship, it's a bit of a strange dynamic when we look at the championship picture, in that when you look at it in pure points terms, you think, well, we've got a championship on, because Marc Marquez leads Valentino Rossi by 27 points, and they were second and third, respectively, at the weekend. Rossi just a place behind Marquez in the race. So you think, if you just looked at it without realising which bikes they're all on, you'd think, oh, well, Rossi's limited the damage, and he's only lost one position and 3 points, 4 points, to Marc Marquez. But the one bike that has the pace to give Marc Marquez a headache and beat him regularly, it's the bike that's been run by the riders in 7th and 8th in the championship. And if anything, Dre, when we look at the season that we've seen so far, Valentino Rossi is kind of punching above his weight by even being this close.
Indeed. Simply put, just not going wrong and just racking up 3rd place and 4th place finishes in a field where a lot of guys are crashing at the moment. A lot of guys are falling off the bikes, trying to chase each other and whatnot, and being, you know, whatever the situation may be. Rossi, on the account of not making very many errors, all of a sudden is now second overall and only 27 off the top of the title race right now. And
he's essentially doing what he did in 2015, but on a much inferior bike.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't think Rossi's going to win the title by doing this, or he's going to have to win races. And, you know, Assen might be the one golden chance he's got left, like he did last year. The one race he won last year was at Assen.
He's talking that down.
And right now, Valentino is not confident on that. I don't think the Yamaha is on the same level it was last year. The way it's going right now. So I think Rossi's played. I mean, this is his signature circuit. He's won here, what was it, 10 times Valentino's won around there? So
including, what, 3 of the last 5 years?
Yeah, exactly. And this is arguably Rossi's best circuit now. And even he's talking now in Assen's chances too. So the way it's going, like, Rossi's probably in the fight for second at the moment, between him and his teammate Mavericks in there as well. Again, he's not having terrible days, but he's just not performing on that level at the moment. But they're not having DNFs, and that right now in itself is valuable.
And outside of Marc Marquez, I mean, the championship positions reflects it anyway, but I'd say outside of Marquez, Valentino Rossi is doing as good a job as anyone this season in MotoGP, and he seems, Dre, to have Maverick Viñales firmly in his back pocket at the moment, which is not something we thought we'd be saying 12 months ago. Because yet again, we seem like a stuck record that we say this after every MotoGP race. Now, this is at least 4 times now this season where we've said Maverick Viñales finishes 6th, all the damage done on lap 1.
It happened again. Maverick Viñales starts well, and then falling down in the really early going. It's not pretty, to say the least. Again, it's another case where Viñales' pace gets better as the race goes on, but it seems that he can't ride this bike when the fuel, when it's on a full tank of fuel. It's very weird. It's happened again. It's not the first time it's happened this season, and it's been a trend.
It's clearly not a new tyres issue because he qualifies well.
Right. It's got to be fuel, and like, how do you get around this? I mean, like, I guess you could run more heavy, maybe run more fuel load setups in practice, but like, this wasn't the problem for Maverick last year. It's happened this season. This has really happened where, you know, this has become a trend where he just falls away at the start of a race and then it'll come back in the second half. But this wasn't a problem for Maverick last year, not at all. I don't know what's caused this. I'm still trying to figure it out, and I've got nothing for you on this one. It's very weird.
It is very weird. Maverick Viñales finished in 6th behind a couple of Hondas. Cal Crutchlow in 4th. If ever anything just exemplified Cal Crutchlow's don't doubt me mantra, it was this one where he was essentially told by Bridgestone and by Honda that, you know, we can't make this medium, or you can't make this medium front tyre, a medium rear tyre work. He did, and finished 4th. With Danny Pedrosa in 5th. And a decent enough ride and a decent enough performance and finish from Cal Crutchlow, Dre, who's kind of blew hot and cold this season. Of course, he did win the Argentine Grand Prix early in the season and led the championship result, and then kind of fell off the radar a little bit since then. What's he done since then? He's had a couple of DNFs back-to-back, or a couple of non-scores, then an 8th and a 6th, now a 4th. And kind of back at the level he was operating at right at the start of the season.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad to see Crutchlow back to something near his best. He had a pretty wretched time off directly after that Argentina win. He was starting on pole position in the ref, and that fell apart very quickly. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, he was in a dogfight with Drosa pretty much all race long, and he beat him to it fair and square. He did a very, very good job where that's concerned. That was the maximum that was on the table for him that weekend. It was in a fight with Pedrosa, and you know, we all know Pedrosa's no slouch. And he came out on top. He did it very, very well indeed. And yeah, that was a solid performance. Only less than 10 seconds off the win really isn't that bad. Only 5 off Marquez is the top Honda. That's where Crutchlow really should be as a rider at this point. So, I mean, you can't moan. 4th place isn't a bad result at all.
Yeah, and usually it's at this stage that we find ample more issues to discuss from us GP race. But apart from Takaki Nakagami wiping Bradley Smith out, that was about it. So here's the result. Jorge Lorenzo, the winner from Marc Marquez. 4.5 seconds in it at the end. Lorenzo just breaking Marc Marquez as Marquez settled for 20 points. Valentino Rossi, 6 seconds off the win in 3rd. That's about where Yamaha are these days. Cal Crutchlow, 4th. Narrowly edging out Pedrosa and Viñales in the battle for 4th, 5th and 6th. Joan Zarco, 7th. He's kind of fallen off the radar. He's had a couple of poor rounds since his home pole position at Le Mans. He was 7th ahead of Danilo Petrucci. Alvaro Bautista, who's had as good a result as he's had all season, on the independent Ducati with the Ancon Nieto team. That's 2 nights in a row for him. With Andrea Iannone, that was the best Suzuki could manage, down in 10th position. A bit of a poor weekend, or a poor Sunday, for them. Paul Espargaró on the sole KTM to a minute to make the checkered flag in 11th. Mika Kallio crashed out on the opening lap. Scott Redding 12th on the sole Aprilia to not break down. 12th for him. Carol Abraham 13th. And Franco Morbidelli, the last classified finisher in 14th, although he had problems as well, got back out on track and finished 3 laps down and got a couple of points for it. No fewer than 12 non-finishers, including Siren, Rabat, Miller, Smith and Nakagami, who we told you about, Rinzu broke down, Doviu crashed, Xavier Simeone, who virtually crashed in every session last weekend, Aleix Espargaró, Tom Lüthi, and so it goes on. 12 non-finishers, nearly almost one short of half the field, failed to finish. In Barcelona, championship standings now look like this. Marc Marquez on 115 points. He extends his lead over Valentino Rossi to 27. Maverick Viñales is a further 11 points back in third. Zarco is 4 points behind Viñales in fourth. Petrucci's fifth. Crutchlow is sixth. Lorenzo, Dovizioso, and Iannone are all level on 66 points in seventh, eighth, and ninth, respectively, with Jack Miller, who is another not to finish, down in 10th on 49 points, one spot ahead of Dani Pedrosa in 12th. Next round of the MotoGP, Moto2 and Moto3 championships, as we mentioned earlier on, is one of the race weekends of the season, one we always look forward to. It is the TT Acid, which is in around about a week's time. Right, on to BSB, who were back in action last weekend at Snetterton after around a month off. Of course, since we last saw British Superbikes out on track on TV, we had the terrible news of Shaky Burns' debilitating accident at Snetterton in testing. We're not going to see him again this season, but good to see via his various social media channels that he is on the mend and recovering well. As we hope to see him again on a Superbike perhaps next year. It's pretty much certain now we're not going to see him for the rest of this season. And not a lot has changed apart from that, really, outside of Shaky Burns' absence, because Leon Haslam remains the class of the field. Once again, Dre, two very, very classy victories for Leon Haslam, who continues to prove that he is a Superbike rider of the highest class and quality, certainly on British shores. And we were discussing this, weren't we, before we started, how he's now won 5 in a row. He's now 64 points clear at the top of the championship. In real time, of course, the showdown will change that, but it doesn't necessarily look like he's a mile better than everybody else. I mean, both of his race wins at Snetterton were by less than a second. In fact, the second of them was by less than a tenth of a second. But this guy is, as I say, such a classy operator, and he continues to find a way of winning.
Indeed he does. Again, it doesn't feel like he's won the last 5 races, and that's not to, you know, dismiss his performances or to talk down of his performances. He's been fantastic, and that's just the thing about it, is that he's just picked his spots so well, and he's just established himself as the class of the field in a field that is, you know, still so up and down right now. A lot of the quality riders we expect in BSB have been up and down a lot of the season. I mean, we saw the disastrous this weekend has been from Bradley Ray. We'll get to that in a bit, but Haslam, you know, he seems to have just a little bit more in him compared to a lot of the other guys in the field. I mean, it was 2 professional jobs here. Race 1, you know, he narrowly beat out Glenn Irwin in a race that, you know, he had to work his way from 6th to get to the front. He did a very good job there. Race 2 was a lot more of a dogfight. Josh Brooks tried to throw the house at the last minute, and Haslam survived. And again, won by a nose in this case, basically. He's doing an excellent job. To do this on the soft tyre, which he's always struggled with, and to win at Snetterton, which he's never won at before, it goes to show you that, you know, okay, it's obviously a bummer that Shaky's not around, but you can only beat what they put in front of you, and Haslam is doing a spectacular job right now.
Yeah, this is a team and a rider operating at the top of their game, because as you mentioned, Haslam hadn't won there before, and he was quick to point out that Snetterton And he likened it to Thruxton, which is another very fast circuit, and Branch GP, a circuit where he goes to expecting to have a tough weekend because it doesn't either suit his style or the bike or the setup that he has on that bike. So for him to leave the place like Stetterton with maximum points is ominous for the rest of the field. He is looking so, so good at the moment. And yeah, he just finds a way to win. He's able, just in these close dogfights, just he's always able just to find the right strategy, find the right way around it. Obviously, that first race, he had Glen Irwin on his tail throughout, but he just doesn't make mistakes, as the other has him. He just did not give Glen Irwin a sniff. Of course, he did duff up Glen Irwin earlier in the season at Brands around the Indy Circuit, didn't he, at that final corner earlier in the year. So that's the second time he's denied Glen Irwin in a very, very close race. That second race, though, Dre, and the aforementioned dogfight with Josh Brooks, came to a head on the final lap. Now, they'd both been caught by Jake Dixon, who we'll talk about shortly. But I want to talk about what happened on the run to the line. Because Josh Brooks basically did the only thing he could do, which was try and dive up the inside of Haslam into the final corner and mess up his exit.
Right.
But Haslam still got a better exit, as he would, because he'd taken the racing line and got the better exit out of the corner. And they're now heading towards the finish line side by side. On the approach to the line, there is a slight right kink before they come onto the main straight. But even so, Josh Brooks appears to go hard left into Leon Haslam. Now, Brooks said afterwards that Haslam was coming past him quicker than he thought, and therefore was probably trying to slot in behind him rather than, you know, straight to the side of him, which I'm struggling to buy. And I have to say, Leon Haslam was incredibly phlegmatic about it after the race. He kind of just said, well, it was a bit hairy, but it's all right because he won. That was another one, much like the incident we discussed post the checkered flag in Moto 2, where I watched that real time and thought, that deserves a second look from the stewards. That could have been horrendous.
Yeah, that could have been a potential disaster at over 160 miles an hour. That's the fastest part of the track, and that was very hairy. And like in real time, it looks like Brooks has intentionally tried to run Haslam onto the grass, which you might be able to get away with in F1 if you had four wheels and a lot more grip. But this is two wheels; you cannot do that. That is an absolute no-no. Whether you want to buy Brooks's statement as to what happened, and whether you believe him, that's ultimately up to you. In real time, it doesn't look that way. I think Haslam always had the better run. He was going to have the better run out of that corner because Brooks dive bombed. Like Brooks dive bombed and took the narrow line on the final corner. So that was always going to be the case. Haslam was always going to come from the corner faster. Brooks is not an idiot. I think he knows that. I think he's tried to save a bit of face by doing that, but I really don't think Brooks was so naive to think that Haslam wasn't going to come down that side of the track so quickly. I mean, the racing line facilitates that. So, yeah, I think you're right. And I also agree that, yeah, I think the steward should have taken another look at that because I think it was dodgy as all hell. And that, you can't let that happen. That's a no-go. You cannot just try to run a guy off the road like that in bike racing. That is a very dangerous thing to do, and even more so at that speed. That is at full racing speed towards the line. You're going about 160 miles an hour. No, do not do that. That's hellacious. You cannot do that at all.
And whilst I understand why not a lot's been made of it since, and I guess if the two riders themselves aren't making a big deal of it, then why should we? Leon Haslam just basically was, he was happy enough, and I can understand why, because he won the race. I do wonder whether Haslam would have been quite so chilled had Jake Dixon mugged the pair of them and got to the line first and won it, or if he'd ended up off the bike and on the grass or in the wall. But even so, I just think it was over the limit of hard racing, because sometimes we see riders, touching in corners, and we discuss it as hard racing. That's fine, but not in a straight at 180 miles an hour. I just think that's too far from Josh Brooks's point of view. If we're going to find a positive, though, and there are many to take from Josh Brooks's weekend, Ray, is that there appeared to be a noticeable step forward from him and McCams last weekend. Now, Josh Brooks describes the changes. First of all, they had an engineer from Yamaha HQ in Italy, essentially Yamaha Europe, in their garage at Stetson. So some factory brake power, which certainly wouldn't have gone amiss, and certainly helped them out. But they also had a different spec of engine, which was a much lesser of an engine spec. It was a more conservative engine. And it didn't give him the outright top speed that he had on his previous engine, but it was more aggressive and was able to give him more drive through the corners and able to get him off the corners quicker as well, able to accelerate out the corner better. And if we're looking at Josh Brooks' season long-term, Dre, this noticeable step up appears to have brought the old Josh Brooks back, which long-term for the rest of the championship is a positive him and for McCams.
Yeah, he was talking about that as early as Friday in practice. He was saying that, yeah, it seems like it's the first weekend, and he seems like he's genuinely confident in himself and his pace. I completely agree. I think this was the Brooks of old. After what's been a temperamental season with the McCams team so far, that was Brooks at his best all weekend long. In both races, he rode very well. Just a fraction off both wins, only 1.8 off in race one, and of course a tenth off the win in race two. That's about as much as you can ask for out of any rider, really. A podium, a fourth and a third, very strong performances. That was the most confident he's looked all season, and I think he's right. I think he has found something here, and we'll see if that continues.
Brooks into the top six in the championship, although Shaky Byrne is still in there. So he's essentially fifth in the championship when we discount Shaky Byrne. I don't think there's a precedent to this. No, Shaky Byrne's not going to make it in, but he's not really lost any points to the guys outside the top six this weekend. But I'm pretty sure if an injured rider did make it in the top six, they would essentially just pull him out of there and promote the seventh guy in. So forget Shaky Byrne in the championship picture, even though he does still sit in third. He's just ahead of Jake Dixon, who's fourth, essentially third. On 91 points, and outside of Haslam, Jake Dixon had the best weekend of anybody in terms of outright points. He was third in race one, second in race two, and very nearly caught Haslam and Brooks out on the blind side to beat them both to win race two. And you know, we discussed, didn't we, before the round at Alton Park over the May Bank Holiday weekend, how Jake Dixon was quizzingly and bizarrely 33-1 to win this British Superbike Championship, which we both thought was incredibly daft and incredibly long odds. And a performance like this kind of justifies why we said that, doesn't it? Because it's clear that on pure pace, Jake Dixon is every bit as good as he was last season.
Right. Yeah, it looks like, again, Dixon of last season is back. I always agreed with you entirely when you said it seemed like a long shot that, you know, why is his odds so long on this one? He's a guy that can win races. He was in the showdown last year. He had some fantastic rides last season, and this was another pair of really good performances from Dixon again here. Him being 33-1 to me was outrageous. He's a much better rider than that. He should be a guy that should be thinking about challenging Haslam for the title now, especially with Shaky out of the way. He will make the showdown, in my opinion. I don't think there's any question about that, given where he is in the standings. I think he's a net third overall once you take Shaky out of the picture. Only 10 points in the regular season behind Bradley Ray now, with those pair of podiums that he had. Yeah, like, he should be a prime contender for the showdown. Now he's capable of podiums, he should be able to rack up some points between now and the showdown.
Yeah, and of course the next round of the British Superbike Championship is the scene of his breakthrough double last year at Knockhill. He was beaten to second in race one by Glenn Irwin. Now, Glenn Irwin was not in the battle for a podium in race two for a very, very good reason. He was involved in an incident with Bradley Ray. Now, the two kissed and made up afterwards. As we saw on social media, Glenn Irwin was very unhappy at the time. He claims he was robbed of a race two victory, which my response to be, oh, would you? Oh, you would say that, Glenn?
Of course,
because there's no way of proving you otherwise. But putting that to one side, is race one result was very, very good. Second place for him. A very, very good dry weather performance from him. And what it does show, even when you forget the fact that he scored no points in race two, Dre, what it kind of shows us is that without Shaky Byrne in the picture, perhaps BYs and Ducati, their title hopes probably aren't as remote as perhaps we thought at the time. And Glenn Irwin, he's another one who's made a noticeable step up this year. And perhaps he is in a position, certainly to make the showdown, and who knows, by the time we get to the autumn, maybe Glenn Irwin will be in a position to perhaps carry that BYs and Ducati title challenge.
Yeah, I talked about this off the air, where when Shaky's old teammate was Stuart Easton, Stuart Easton felt like a lot more like a backup for Shaky, given their respective quality. Glenn Irwin doesn't have that. Glenn Irwin, I think, is a cut above that. Irwin looks like a guy who can now win races and actually, you know, be a consistent contender. Someone who could be an elite guy in this field. Someone like a Haslam, a Bradley Ray, a Dixon, you know, Jason O'Halloran, that sort of level where he's now in the podiums on a regular basis. He was unlucky in race two, no question about that. It's the unfortunate victim of Bradley Ray losing the front and being collected. That's that's bike racing sometimes, unfortunately. But yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, Irwin looks like a guy who should be in the showdown this year. He was on the fringes of it last year. He's improved, I think, since then, now where he can challenge for wins on a more frequent basis. Why not think about the title? Why not spearhead that team while Shaky's gone? Like, there's no reason not to at the moment.
Yeah, he is fifth in the championship / fourth once his teammate drops out of there. Now, we mentioned Bradley Ray, who, of course, had his own accident, which collected Glenn Irwin in race two. He's still second overall, is Brad Ray, because obviously the next man behind him in the championship was sitting in hospital with a birdcage on his head. And he's still, in the grand scheme of things, in terms of the championship, this is bizarre to say this, but he's scored no points at Stetson. He's crashed out twice, but he probably hasn't lost a lot, has he? He's lost 10 points in podium points to Haslam, but he's still going to make the showdown. And I guess what Bradley Ray will be thinking coming away from Stetson is that I scored no points, but on pure pace, I still had the pace to perhaps win both races there. And he was on pole, let's not forget, as well.
He did. It could be. It's more the case if he's lost 10 podium points to Haslam, and that's going to be a problem. That could be problematic going forward. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, it was a bit of a bad weekend for Bradley in the sense of, yeah, he didn't finish either race, and he lost the front both times. Similar corner as well, where he just tucked the front and lost it.
But leading race one, wasn't he, when he fell off?
Yeah, exactly. He was leading race one. He was third in race two when he crashed out. The pace is there. And like, again, it just proves that Suzuki is no fluke. It really is up there now as a top-tier contending bike. But yeah, Bradley's going to keep it upright a bit more frequently if he needs to get around that, because yeah, that's not going to wash in the long run. You can have a bad weekend or two, but once it gets to the showdown, that could be problematic. So yeah, like it's slightly reassuring given the overall speed of the car, but yeah, at the moment they need more than that.
Yeah, I mean, I often tend to look at things a lot more glass half full than most. And if I'm Bradley Ray, I'm sat there thinking every round that goes by just serves as more sort of confirmation that he is there for the long haul and he's there for the rest of the season. And that
absolutely, you know,
this early season form is not going to tail off. He's keeping this going for the entire year, because every round that we go to is both new ground for Bradley Ray in BSB, but also new ground for this Suzuki in BSB, because it's not contended at this level. This new GSXR 1000, it's not contended at this level in BSB before. So with every round that goes by, they continue to learn more and they continue to validate what they've done so far, and that they are there for the long haul. As we sit here in the championship, Haslam leads it from Ray and Byrne, with Dixon fourth, Irwin fifth, and Brooks in sixth. But if you take Shaky Byrne out, we have two riders tied for sixth. Jason O'Halloran is one, and Danny Buchan is the other. Now, Buchan had two fifth places at Stetson last weekend, and on his return to the championship, he's having a very, very good season, is Buchan, on the FS3, independently run Kawasaki. As far as the Hondas are concerned, though, Dre, both of them, of course, returning from injuries. O'Halloran broke his leg at Imola in World Superbike duty. Of course, hasn't really missed a British round, because there was that big 1 month 5 week gap. Linfoot, though, racing for the first time since the opening round of the season at Donington Park. And it was fair to say that they didn't exactly get the welcome back that they were hoping for in the form of an out-of-control Andy Irwin in race one. Both O'Hanlon and Linfoot skittled out at turn two by a rider making his British Superbike debut in Andrew Irwin on the second BYZ Ducati. And no matter how inexperienced the rider you are in the championship that you're racing in, there's no excuse for that.
No, that was reckless. Fortunately, there's no getting. It's lap one. It's turn two. You can't win a race on the opening lap, but you sure as hell can lose one. And yeah, just it was a reckless dive down the inside. He was never going to make the apex of that hairpin, not even close. You can't do that on lap one. There's going to be at least two bikes on the outside of you. And in this case, there was three. He skittled out both Hondas and Michael Laverty as well for the BMW team. I mean, fair play to him. He went to both garages and immediately apologised. He knew he was in the wrong, which is good to see. But at the same time, I mean, yeah, a debut to forget for Andrew Irwin on that one. Just silly riding, unfortunately, and he'll learn from that.
Yeah, he did atone a little bit in race two. He finished in 10th position, which I guess for a rider in his second British Superbike race is not a bad result at all. For Andrew Irwin, the brother, if you're wondering, yes, they are brothers, Andrew and Glenn Irwin, the teammates at BYZ Ducati. And we'll see how many times Andrew Irwin races for that BYZ team this season. There were rumours going around that he might well be riding for them for the rest of the season, but if you take one look at the corresponding calendars of British Superbikes and World Supersport, in which he currently races regularly, there are a lot of clashes. In fact, the only round of the World Supersport Championship which doesn't clash with BSB that remains is the final round in Qatar. So if Andrew Irwin is going to race for the rest of the season with BYZ Ducati, he's essentially going to have to bin off his World Supersport commitment. So we'll see how that transpires. But from Honda's point of view, though, Dre, not a bad weekend, I suppose. I mean, O'Halloran scored no points, but he's still in the top six. Once you take Shaky Byrne out, he's sixth overall. And Dan Linfoot, returning from injury and showing that he's clearly not missed a step, Dan Linfoot has only raced in four British Superbike races this season, when you take into account all the injuries that he's had. And yet he's still, let's count it up, he is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. He's 11th in the championship, /10th. He's raced in four races this season, and in three of them he's been 4th, 3rd, 4th. Clearly, when the rider's fully fit and the bike's fully upright, that's a weapon, Linfoot, on that Honda.
Yeah, like that, the Fireblade is good, and again, that team is good for sure. So, yeah,
he's a bit of a false position, isn't he, in the championship?
Indeed, exactly. Again, the injuries for both of their riders and time hasn't helped without any doubt. But yeah, like without question, the Fireblade is getting better and better. It's a contending bike now for sure, where they can regularly be in the podiums. Spots and like both riders, I think, should make the showdown by the time it's all said. No, Halloran is in the top six effectively right now, and Linfoot, I'm sure, will gather because I mean, Linfoot is a different rider from the guy he was this time last year. It was the showdown last year, it looked like Linfoot had finally turned the corner. So yeah, the way it's going right now, I think there is a lot to look forward to in the Honda team. I think, despite the results on paper being quite bad, I don't see any reason, why both Hondas still can't make the showdown.
Yeah, because we still have 11 races to go before the showdown spots are locked in. We have two at Knockhill, two at Brands GP, two at Thruxton, two at Cadwell, and three at Silverstone before we settle our top six. So a lot of time still for Linfoot to climb into that top six. And yeah, I'm with Dre. I think he will by the time we get to Silverstone on the first weekend of September. A couple of other riders that we want to mention before we move on. The Tyco BMW riders, of course. Michael Laverty was the other rider taken out in that first lap collision with Andrew Irwin and the Hondas. He, though, did come back to finish 9th in race 2. Christian Iden, on his return from injury, 9th and 8th for him in his two rounds. He is up in 9th in the championship, although I would say, if I was being slightly harsh on Iden, 8th and 9th do not get you in the showdown. He's probably going to have to do a little bit more than that To get in, but a solid enough return from injury for him. And, you know, as I say, at least he did score points, so he's kept himself in and around the top six. The one other rider, though, that we want to mention is Luke Mossy. He's not had the greatest of seasons. Of course, he's probably had... he's impressed us more for his work as a World Superbike wildcard than what he's done in BSB this season. He's only got 23 points to his name so far this season. But what happened to him in race one deserves mentioning, and it kind of beggars belief. A 180-mile-an-hour brake failure at the end of the Bentley Straight at Snetterton. He missed race two, presumably because he was still busy shitting himself. After what had happened, he did actually break a rib, being serious, which is why he missed race two. But I have to say, Dre, that's about as scary as motorcycle racing gets.
Oh dear God, not another one for us for the Speed Fit team. We also, Leon Haslam, have one at a very similar speed, and that was the final round of the championship. Yeah, of course, the championship of Brands Hatch. Yeah, not ideal, to say the least. It's a real shame on that one. It keeps happening to Kawasaki. It's unfortunate, to say the least. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that is utterly terrifying. No, thank you. To have another, you know, ridiculous brake failure. That, and again, that is so dangerous. My livers would be brown if that was happening. 180 miles an hour brake failure is utterly scary. Luckily, Mossy wasn't too seriously hurt from it. The guy needs some luck. He's had it wretched for the last season or so now. Where Mossy's talent is fantastic, but he's just had unmitigating circumstances really hurt him. This one, it's a shame.
Yeah, it is a shame, and it kind of, again, puts you into the mind of a motorcycle racer at this level, which we really struggle to do. We struggle to sort of comprehend how their minds operate, where we said this after Haslam's crash, didn't we, at Brands last season, where it was like, how do you get into that mindset where you're at 180 miles an hour, you've got no brakes, and you're travelling at that speed, and you suddenly have to make the decision, I've got to jump off this? Like,
yeah.
How on earth? Like, obviously, that was clearly the right decision. You can't stay on the bike
because
you're going to kill you. But that's that part of the brain that motorcycle racers have that us mere mortals don't have, where it's like you've got to think so quickly and you've got to have that part of your brain working where it's like I've got to jump off this bike, even though every fibre of my being, every piece of logic in my head is telling me you never jump off a motorcycle at 180 miles an hour. But that's what I've got to do. And Luke Mossy was. As it describes in BS in MCN, a visibly shaken Mossy. I'm not surprised.
He
says, we've had some brake issues before, but this time they completely failed. I had nothing there at all, so I had no choice but to bail out. You're playing with people's lives when these stupid things are happening. I'm speechless. Which is obviously a bit of a pointed comment at his team and at Kawasaki to try and avoid these things from happening in the future. Because, yeah, 180 mile an hour to have no brakes is a big, big no-no. In British Superbikes or in anything. So thank goodness Luke Mossy is okay. Yeah. At the end of all that, his championship, though, is looking decidedly dodgy at the moment, as we tell you now. First of all, here's how the two races finished. Haslam winning race one from Irwin and Dixon, with Brooks fourth, Buchan fifth, Tas McKenzie, brother of Taylor, teammate to Brooks, sixth on the other McCown's Yamaha, ahead of Peter Hickman, seventh on the BM, fresh from his TT successes. James Ellison, eighth on the Anvil Hire Tag Yam. Christian Eden 9th and Richard Cooper on the sole remaining build-based Suzuki in 10th. Race 2 once again went to Haslam, this time from Buchan and Brooks. Just a tenth of a second split the three of them. Linfoot 4th ahead of Buchan and 5th. Hickman 6th. Cooper 7th. Eden 8th. Laverty 9th and Andrew Irwin in 10th position for his first BSB points. Haslam leads the championship then at the moment on 165 points. Bradley Ray on 101. Still on brand. Shaky Bird 3rd on 98, Dixon 4th on 91, Irwin 5th on 79, and Brooks 6th on 72. That is where your showdown spots cut off at the moment, with O'Halloran next up on 63, ahead of Buchan also on 63, Eden on 48, and Michael Laverty completes the top 10 on 46 points. Next round of the British Superbike Championships, as I mentioned, is at Nook Hill in Scotland, and that is, well, as you're listening to this, probably a couple of weeks from now. It is the 8th of July at Nook Hill. Right then, a bit of news to bring you before we go and before we preview this weekend. We're once again sticking with superbikes, and the Endurance World Championship has its final round of the championship with the world-famous Suzuka 8-Hour, which is in July. Now, the picture for that race is becoming clearer and clearer. We already told you earlier this year that Kawasaki are breaking out the big guns, or the biggest of big guns, by running world champion Jonathan Rea on their Team Green Kawasaki ZX-10R. So Yamaha have responded by essentially naming the same lineup that's won the last 3 8-hours in the form of Katsuyuki Akasuga, Yamaha trusted lieutenant, and the World Superbike duo of, and of course these are now both World Superbike winners, Alex Lowes and Michael van der Mark. Again, a strong team, Dre, to line up for Yamaha on that number 21 at the 8-hour of the season to try and take on the might of Honda and, of course, Kawasaki, who are running Jonathan Rea, as well as Leon Haslam, let's not forget, on their bike this year. But our major takeaway from the announcement this week about Yamaha's 8-hour commitments is just how bloody gorgeous that livery is.
You know, I think it's the 20th anniversary. The red, white, and the black one, it's stunning. It's like I mentioned this before to Lewis. I used to be a bike model collector when I was a child. I was like 6 years old. And I remember the very first one I got was of that exact same R1 YZF livery, and it was just simply stunning. And that was like 20 years in the making, seeing that again from, you know, from childhood Dre to now. So it is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Gosh, I wish you could see it more often, but yeah, it's truly brilliant. I think it's fantastic, and I can't wait to see it in action.
Yeah, Yamaha's number 21 at the Suzuka 8-hour will have, as I mentioned, Katsuyuki Akasuga, Alex Lowes, and Michael van der Mark. That will be their lineup this year. As I mentioned, Jonathan Rea will be part of the Kawasaki team alongside Leon Haslam and another of Kawasaki's Japanese test riders. 28th and 29th of July is the weekend where the Suzuka 8-hour will be taking place, and I can't wait for it already. It's a month from now, but we can't wait for that. It's going to be a brilliant, brilliant race in Japan. We're hoping for some brilliant racing this weekend as well, as World Superbikes goes stateside to Laguna Seca for the American round. Of course, we'll be reviewing that next week here on Bike Live, although we won't, of course, have Super Sport or Super Sport 300 to talk about, because it's just the superbikes that go over to Laguna Seca due to the size of the paddock, and of course they share it with the American Superbikes Moto America. Now, we don't know quite, Dre, what kind of racing we're going to get this weekend. Laguna Seca can be a bit hit and miss, but one thing we can say was that World Superbikes have certainly gone the right way about promoting their race weekend, because we were treated earlier this week to the spectacular sight of a number of World Superbikes' finest names, including Jonathan Rea, Chaz Davis and Alex Lowes, riding across the Golden Gate Bridge on street models of their superbikes. Quite a sight.
Oh, it was stunning. It's a bit of a motorsport habit now. Whenever there's a race in California, someone's got to take a press shot over the bridge. I know IndyCar did it a couple of years back for their return to Sonoma. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Seeing the bikes and the riders over Golden Gate Bridge is a hell of a sight. Fantastic way to get some promotion for what is essentially the big biking part of the US. I mean, they love their bikes in that side of the world. Laguna Seca has got such a rich racing history with bikes and in cars in general. So yeah, fantastic a bit of promotion for the race.
Absolutely. Now, in terms of what's going to happen this weekend, one thing to point out, first of all, no Michael Rubin Rinaldi. If you followed us at the start of the season, you'll know this already, in that the junior Aruba Ducati team are only running Rinaldi at the European rounds, which means he's not Laguna Seca this weekend. The other thing, Guandolini Yamaha, Andre Jezek this weekend. He's been replaced by the 2016 Bike Live Loser of the Year, Carol Haneke, who's making his World Superbike debut this weekend. So he's out there. We've also got a wild card in Josh Herrin, former Moto 2 tailender and Moto America front runner. He's wild carding on the same Yamaha that he's racing in the Moto America Championship with. Literally the same bike is riding in the Moto America and World Superbike classes this weekend. So it's going to be getting the mileage in. that Yamaha this weekend, and he's been 13th quickest in the two practice sessions we've had so far. We are talking to you as we record this between free practice two and practice three on Friday at Laguna Seca. One of our guests who's been fastest so far, listeners, correct, got it in one, Jonathan Rea, who was 4/10 clear of Marco Melandri and Tom Sykes, who were second and third and 1/100th apart. So the tone has been set for what we're going to see for the rest of this weekend, but we shall see how it pans out. As it stands, as we're talking to you, I know this is completely redundant by the time you listen to this, but anyway, we'll tell you. Jonathan Rea from Melandri and Sykes, with Alex Lozen in 4th, Eugene Laverty 5th, Jordi Torres 6th, Chaz Davies only 7th, ahead of Xavi Forres, who's up in 8th, so signs that he's back to somewhere near his best form again, with Lorenzo Savadori 9th and Michael Vandermark in 10th. But of course, we'll see how the weekend progresses from there. Race 1 Saturday night, race 2 Sunday night. Of course, for us in the UK, brilliant time for the races. They're both at 10 p.m. UK time, Saturday night and Sunday night. So lovely stuff. World Superbikes at Laguna Seca this weekend. And we'll review it all next week on Bike Live. Before we go, then, let's tell you about the places you can find us. Starting on Facebook, facebook.com/motorsport101. On Twitter, we are at motorsport_101. On YouTube, it's youtube.com/motorsport101. Our website is motorsport101.com, where you can find written pieces from plenty of the team on there, including Dre's piece on Ducati's current predicament in MotoGP. And if you want to back us financially and earn yourself early access to both of our weekly shows, patreon.com/motorsport101 is the place to go. $5 backing earns you the podcast before everyone else. $10 backing earns you access to our Discord server where you can listen in live. Although, as Dre has mentioned earlier on, if you back us at any level whatsoever, you get early access to next week's Motorsport 101 episode 147, which Dre will be reviewing both the latest round of the IndyCar Championship, which takes place this weekend, and IndyCar's in Wisconsin, by the way, and the Formula 1, which is back at Paul Ricard. And at this very early stage, and we're speaking to you after Friday, and Ferrari always seem to sandbag on a Friday, but yeah, you might be it might be coming up 44 this weekend if Friday's anything to go by.
Yeah, it's looking that way. Mercs have got their knee in. It's a power circuit, a lot of long straights at Paul Ricard, and yeah, the way it's going at the moment, it's looking a lot like it could be a Mercedes beat them down for the weekend. So we'll have to wait and see how that goes. Red Bull do look pretty quick out there as well, to be fair, which, given, again, it's a power circuit, it actually makes the Red Bull look even more impressive. Hopefully, when it comes to qualifying itself, it tells a different story. But yes, you know, pretty dramatic Paul Ricard weekend so far. Sure, so shame to hear so many fans missed out on being there for practice day because they only put one lane of traffic going into the track for a Grand Prix expecting 80,000 people. Where to go, guys? Really clever. But we'll have all the...
It isn't designed for racing.
Really? It's almost like it's a test circuit or something. Yeah. Funny that. But yeah, we'll try and pick together what happens at Paul Ricard this weekend, and we'll talk about the French Grand Prix. I mean, yeah, it's great to have a French Grand Prix again, but they couldn't have just gone back to Magny-Cours. No. But anyway.
As Ryan King terms it on this week's 101, the granddaddy of them all. And as we've mentioned, Road America IndyCar this weekend indeed. As well.
Indeed.
So we have that to all look forward to on episode 147 of Motorsport 101 next week. Yeah, it's. I mean, we don't know yet whether it's going to be a double, but we shall see. Potentially 147 and 148, depending on how much happens in this two series that we're mentioning this weekend, which means that we could either be 2 weeks or 3 weeks away for episode 150, which is a milestone to be noted, coming up sometime in July. But that brings us to the end of this week's Bike Live. Next week, episode 66. If the motorcycle racing gods have any kind of knowledge of the numbers of our shows, Tom Sykes will clean up. Probably won't happen though. But whatever happens at Laguna Seca this weekend, we'll review it all on Bike Live next week for episode 66. For myself and Dre, until then, it's bye-bye.